the dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true. I love you.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you. This is John Barber. Welcome to John Barber's World here in Las Vegas, Nevada. That was Sarita singing Sunny to yours truly and Frank Sinatra introducing yours truly the night he hosted the Tonight Show replacing Johnny Carson all week long here in Las Vegas. It's been around 114 degrees, but it won't be nearly as hot as tonight's show. Very shortly, you're going to meet and hear from the brilliant writer-lawyer who right now is one of the most important voices in America. In his new earth-shattering, establishment-rattling book, The Plot to Kill the King, he has totally and convincingly unraveled the plot to murder Dr. Martin Luther King, uncovering all the players, some who will shock you, some who won't, and he names the shooter to whom he spoke. As Betty Davis said in All About Eve, quote, "Fasten your seatbelt, folks. It's going to be a bumpy night," unquote. Bumpy because just before you meet him, and almost as important, I'm going to tell you very quickly about a film you absolutely must see. That is, if you're thrilled to be learning something historically relevant, presented in outstanding filmic fashion. If so, you must see The Free State of Jones with Matthew McConaughey. This remarkable true story is not taught in universities and is probably the most important untold story of the entire Civil War. Surprisingly absent from Ken Burns' lauded documentary about the Civil War, and I think you'll see why in a minute. It is, by far, the best film I have seen in 15 years, and not surprisingly, bombed by the New York Times, calling it gruesomely violent. What is gruesome, folks, is the corruption the film reveals about America. A corruption that has metastasized throughout our whole society, beginning with and including and ever since the Civil War. The lead character's name, a true character, is Newton Knight, a deserter from the Confederate Army because he says, "We're just a bunch of poor people killing other poor people so the rich can get and stay rich." In the South, there was a law. If you owned 20 slaves, you did not have to fight or pay taxes. If you were poor, you were drafted. If you were a poor farmer, the government took 90% of your crops and livestock to support the troops. Newton Knight, the deserter, for his family, takes up arms against the militia tax collectors and is forced to flee into the swamps where he's rescued by runaway slaves. With these slaves and a few deserters, he decides that the wealthy landowners should also be paying their fair share of taxes and, like an early Robin Hood, sets out to collect very successfully. Each battalion sent by the government to kill him in turn is wiped out by these integrated renegades. In short order, they control nearly half a state, which they call, quote, the Free State of Jones, their credo. No man, white or black, is another man's nigger. The lead character, played perfectly by McConaughey, was to me much more of an interesting and inspiring American hero than George Washington. George Washington was fighting to change ownership of land from Englishmen to Americans. In this stirring film, you'll see Newt Knight was fighting to change the system. It was, in essence, America's first poor people's march, America's first poor people's rebellion. No wonder it's not included in Ken Burns' documentary and bombed by the New York Times. Also, in the film are two interlocking love stories. Even if you care nothing about politics or history, you will love this film just because of the background love stories. This remarkably inspiring film, which should be must viewing in every history class, political science class, in every university in the country, was written and directed by Gary Ross. I'm going to post this review on my Facebook page. Do yourself an intellectual and emotional favor and go see it. Then do me a favor and post a comment. Now, if this is a great film, I've just finished reading an even greater true detective story and one of the most important stories in all of American history, just out from Skyhorse Publishing, The Plot to Kill the King. The first half is this compelling, mind-expanding, really well-written story of how the author pursued the plot to kill the king until he solved it. This alone should be required reading for every American. The second half should be required reading for every lawyer and law student. It is filled with references, depositions, invaluable background information. And back with us, for the second time in a month, the amazing author, lawyer for the entire King family, William Pepper. William, welcome to the show and congratulations on truly an outstanding, outstanding book.
Thank you, John. It's good to be with you.
Well, it's more than a delight to have you here, especially, you know, William, I thought I knew a lot about the King case, having gotten involved with Robert Kennedy and John Kennedy and Jim Garrison. But I was astonished and shocked and even inspired by much of what I read, which we're going to have you impart to the audience shortly. So let's begin with the reason you brought the civil suit, against whom you brought the civil suit. And once the civil suit was resolved, what was it that compelled you to go that one step further on your own to pursue this plot?
Well, we brought the civil suit, and I represented the King family in that civil action, against a man called Lloyd Jowers, whom we knew was a part of the overall conspiratorial action to kill King. We had him nailed fairly convincingly and broke him down. He admitted his role, and we believed that by suing him civilly and indicating that there were other individuals involved, both governmental agents and private individuals, that we would get that much further along the road to getting the truth about the assassination of Dr. King. James Earl Ray, who had been my client for 10 years, died in 1998. And normally that would be the end of this struggle for truth, because we had tried to get James a trial and tried to get even an evidentiary hearing for him. And we were unsuccessful. But in a conversation with the family of Dr. King, I suggested that since we had so much evidence on, and really admissions on from this Mr. Lloyd Jowers, who owned the grill. It was a downstairs grill underneath the rooming house that backed onto the Lorraine Motel where Dr. King was staying.
William, excuse me. Exactly what did Jowers admit to as far as his participation was concerned, and how much money changed hands?
Well, Jowers admitted finally to being out in the brush area with the shooter and a spotter, though he would never name the shooter. I had to get to that later. He would not name the shooter, but he admitted to being out there and in the bushes. And after the near fatal shot was fired, he admitted after pressure and testimony from a witness who saw him, he admitted taking the rifle from the shooter, bringing it back in through the back door of the kitchen to his little cafe grill, and breaking it down in front of a woman who had been his lover named Betty Spates. And it was Betty who described that whole scene of him running in white as a ghost with the rifle, breaking it down and saying, "You wouldn't ever do anything to hurt me, would you, Betty?" And of course, and on the spur of the moment, she said, "No, Lloyd, of course I wouldn't." But it was many years later, like 24, 25 years later, that I got Betty to tell this whole story.
How much money did Bowers say he was paid?
Well, Jowers had a gambling debt to a man named Frank Liberto. Frank Liberto was one of Carlos Marcello's henchmen in Memphis. And that gambling debt was to be forgiven. And he was given in the area of $100,000, which he put in a stove in the back kitchen of his grill. And eventually took that money and bought a taxi cab company after the assassination. So that was the money that he was given.
The astonishing thing to me was you said that your client, James Earl Ray, died in 1998. But you got Jowers, I think you got him to admit on ABC television, I think it was a primetime show about this. Could you expand
well, Jowers,
on that? That was 1993, I believe, wasn't it?
Yeah, Jowers was in a very difficult position because increasingly he knew that we had evidence against him, and he was actually afraid that he was going to be indicted. He never really understood the fact that the power structure was not ever going to indict him. They only wanted to cover up the whole assassination, and he would have benefited from that. He was afraid he was going to be indicted, so he started to come forward and admit his involvement early on. But it was only when we really had him in the late 90s, and we started the lawsuit against him, that we were able to deal with the facts of his involvement.
Well, didn't he say on that ABC special, that primetime special, that James Earl Ray had nothing to do with the shooting? Didn't he say that?
He basically said that. I don't know that he completely absolved James. I don't remember all the text of what he said, but he, by claiming his acknowledging his own involvement, he basically absolved James, yes.
And you said in the book, which did not surprise me in the least, that was major news, and not even ABC News carried that story.
No. The mainstream media has blocked the truth on this case forever.
Well, as in the case of Lee Harvey Oswald, where Ruby was given the assignment to off Oswald, wouldn't the government have been better off if they had offed James Earl Ray? And didn't they try to?
They did try. They did try to get rid of James on a couple of occasions, even once allowed him to escape from prison in Brushy Mountain Penitentiary. And the idea, they had a couple of snipers in there, and the idea was to kill him and not take him back, allow him back into the prison. So there were various efforts to get rid of James, but none of them really succeeded.
For you,
obviously.
For you, what was the most astonishing or surprising thing when you got into the case? Because it's, as I read the book, I see there were a number of civilians and a number of low-life folk in there, and all of a sudden, in creeps military intelligence somewhere along the way. Did that surprise you at all, or did you expect that the government at that high of a level would have also taken up the task of killing King?
Well, I wasn't totally surprised, but I didn't realize the extent to which the planning went as far up as it did. I didn't anticipate the involvement, the specific involvement of Clyde Tolson, who kept coming and going from Memphis with instructions and money he was carrying for J. Edgar Hoover, who was his, he was number two, as you know, to Hoover, and he was Hoover's lover. And he was in and out of Memphis on a regular basis, and he worked very closely with the Dixie Mafia, who had the obligations and undertook the work on the ground. So Tolson and Hoover were very much involved. Military intelligence, the 902nd Military Intelligence Group based in the Pentagon, had a backup role. They didn't kill or attempt to kill Martin King, but they were there. They had two snipers and two spotters, and they were there to kill. They were there to shoot if, in the event that the civilian shooter, who was a Memphis police officer, was not successful, they were going to shoot. They were not going to let Martin King leave Memphis. And so military intelligence was involved as a backup operation. They also were involved through psychological operations. They had two photographers on the roof of the fire station, and they photographed everything that took place.
Do these photographs exist?
Oh, yes. Of course they do.
Have you tried to get access?
Yes, we tried. We spoke to both photographers, or one of my emissaries spoke to both photographers, and the main photographs were sent back to Colonel Downey, who ran the 902nd Military Intelligence Group. They were sent back to Downey, but one of the photographers kept a set. And we negotiated and tried to get those photographs. And my agent made a mistake. He traveled into that meeting in Miami under his own name. And we were all under pretty heavy surveillance throughout this period. And the FBI followed him. And then as he was engaged in negotiations, they stuck a telephoto lens out the passenger side of their car, and that spooked the photographer, and he just then took off, and we were not successful in getting the photographs.
Is there any possible way that you could go to members of Congress with this information and have them demand to see the photographs?
No,
to make
they,
them...
won't. They won't touch it. They don't want to touch this. You could always go to somebody in Congress, and somebody in Congress could ask the military to go into their archives, and because those photographs, I'm sure, exist. But they, for the most part, will not touch this at all.
If this was as high then as military intelligence, and obviously it was, then it had to be. There had to be, as in Dallas, there were key players in the Dallas Police Department involved with the murder of John Kennedy. Participated in the murder of John Kennedy. There had to be people in the Memphis Police Department who were also going to be involved with the murder of Martin Luther King.
Of course there were. The director of police and fire was the man who primarily, Frank Holloman, was the man who primarily orchestrated the events on the ground. When the patriarch of the Dixie Mafia family died, Russell Adkins, about a year before, in July 67, the torch of assassination was passed to his son, Russell Jr., but it became evident that Russell Jr. really was under the control and the consulting power of Frank Holloman, who was the director of police and fire. And Holloman had been in Hoover's office, worked as an administrator in Hoover's office for a number of years, was very close to Hoover and that operation. And he basically ran it. Memphis Police Department was heavily involved. The shooter of Martin King was a Memphis police officer.
His name? So,
sorry?
His name is in the book.
His name is Frank Strauser, S-T-R-A-U-S-S-E-R.
Tell us how you came upon him and how you happened to interview him. And, I mean, it's astonishing that you have all this information and nobody's suing you.
Well, I mean, anybody can sue if they want. I only state what I got from depositions in the book, and these are statements that witnesses have made under oath. And I'm quick to say and clear to say that these are allegations that people have made, and I don't testify to the absolute veracity or truthfulness of a lot of the allegations. I do say I don't believe these witnesses, and there are, as you know, a good number of witnesses, had any reason to lie under oath. And so they were deposed, they were sworn, they were deposed, they testified, they were filmed. I got to know who I came to receive allegations about as the shooter by a janitor who worked in the Memphis Police Department firing range. And he was the one who came forward and discussed and narrated for me, recited the activities on April 3rd and 4th of this shooter who was given a special rifle and who practiced continually with that rifle down at the shooting range, and then who left with the rifle at about 3:30 on the afternoon of the assassination and drove into Memphis. But he went beyond that. He also told me that every time anything new came up on the case and there was any publicity, that this same person would show up around his house in an unmarked car.
Oh, my goodness.
And
gracious.
Once when he was going into his house to light, he lit a cigarette. He smelled gas. Someone had turned on the gas. And so he had to put out the cigarette very quickly. And then in the back garden, there was a tree that had a target shooting V that had been put up in the branches of the tree that came down and was aimed right at his back window. And then he was also told by this person, this alleged shooter, that he should come with him one day, and they were going to drive down and pick up some paychecks for the staff at the shooting range. And in the course of that journey downtown, fellow showed his gun and also pumped him very heavily upon what he believed happened. And did he believe James Earl Ray was the shooter? So this guy really was very nervous about what this janitor, whose name was Lenny Curtis, very courageous man, what he saw, what he could have seen and what he could have heard, and made Lenny extremely anxious. I could not reveal Lenny's name for a number of years, because I was afraid they would kill him, so I had to protect him.
I asked the shooter
to have lunch with me, and I offered to pay him $500 to have lunch with me, which he agreed. And in the course of that lunch, I confronted him, and I said that Lloyd Jowers had named him as the shooter, and that was how I opened the door to his potential involvement.
So I lied to him. In your book, I get a kick out of the fact that you sort of shyly say that you sort of had to lie to him about that, that Lloyd Jowers had mentioned his name.
Yeah.
And what was his response? His response, as I read it in the book, is like an admission that he did it.
Well, No, he was taken aback, and he said, "Oh, he couldn't imagine why Jowers would say that about him." And then when I asked him to say where he was on the day of the shooting, he sort of fudged that all over the place, and he had no really clear recollection of where he was. And then I told him we had two plaster of Paris molds of footprints that we believe belonged to the shooter, who, after he shot, ran back toward the rooming house. And I said these were a very large size, around size 13, and it had rained much the night before, so these footprints were clear in the mud, and that's why the plaster of Paris molds were made. And I said to him then, I said, "Now tell me, Frank, what size shoe do you wear?" And he looked at me with a little bit of a grin and said, "13 large."
didn't he also say, "Why would they bother with me after 40 years or 30 years?
Well, he didn't say that to me, but he said that to one of my street people who knew him for 30 years and got into the back of his cab one day and confronted him unexpectedly and said to him, "Frank, it looks as though Pepper's got a lot of evidence against you, and it's possible that you might get indicted for this shooting of King." And it was then he blurted out, "What are they going to? Are they going to charge me with something I did 30 years ago or knew about?"
Oh my gosh! Well, now really disturbing things that I need to get into. One is, first of all, Dr. King was not going to originally stay at the Lorraine Motel. And J. Edgar Hoover got somebody to write an article about, if, you know, he's all for blacks, why doesn't he stay at a black establishment? So he changed to the Lorraine Motel. But wasn't he supposed to be on either the first or the second floor? And one of his associates talked him into moving up onto the third floor into the balcony?
Well, not exactly like that, but he was supposed to be in room 202, which was a ground floor room that was heavily secured and safe, and that's why he was put there. And he was moved to room 306, which was an open air balcony room. That's where.
Who encouraged him to move, though? Somebody had to talk him into moving.
You've got to understand, this whole operation was coordinated by Dixie Mafia people on the ground. And Russell Adkins, who was the head of that mafia family, died, and then his son took over. But then Holloman came in, and Holloman, the director of police and fire, really ran the operation. Frank Holloman, from what I have been told under oath, again, by the son of Russell Adkins, Ron Tyler Adkins, told me, we had lengthy deposition of Ron Tyler Adkins, and he, as it was a kid, and he used to sit in on these meetings that involved his father in the planning, and his brother then, and Holloman, in the planning of the assassination. And he told me that his mother received a phone call from his elder brother, his son, Russell Jr. And his mother was told by Russell Jr. to organize to get O.C. Evers, who was a black member, a black person who worked for that family and was one of their people, get O.C. Evers to organize the movement of Dr. King from that ground floor room to 306. So he remembers going out and getting a special number for O.C., bringing it back to his mother, and the mother calling O.C. Evers, and Evers telling the mother that he'd have to call her back, whatever he was doing, he was going to call her back. So he called her back, and Ron was at her elbow when he says, Now, remember, these are depositions under oath, so they involve allegations. He was, and the allegations are not something I was privy to. I was not there. I can't testify that this is a fact. I can just report what I've been told under oath by a witness, and that's really what I'm doing, and I'm making it clear it's an allegation. He, Evers called him back, and he heard her tell Evers to go get Jesse and ask Jesse to go to the owner of the motel and change, have Martin King's room changed. And that's what he heard. And in fact, of course, the room was changed. That's a matter of fact. Now, did Jesse Jackson actually carry out that instruction that was coming to him indirectly from O.C. Evers? I don't know. I wasn't there. I didn't hear it. I'm just reporting what the scenario was that I've been told under oath. And I have to make it clear that these are allegations, even though they're sworn testimony, they're allegations.
Well,
Martin King was then moved from room 202 to room 306.
Well, you're well aware of the fact that, because I mentioned this to you last time, that Dick Gregory goes around and makes a very substantial living showing films and talking about the murder of Martin Luther King. And he has three times, at separate occasions, said that Jesse Jackson was a participant on behalf of the government to murder Martin Luther King, and he has yet to be sued by Jesse Jackson. And Dick sort of waffles at the name Ralph Abernathy. Now, Abernathy, I understand from the book, was even in the hospital room with Dr. King?
Well, you know, Ralph, there are a lot of questions about Ralph that I have. There's no question about that. There are a lot of questions that I have about Ralph. I do know that Ralph was in the room with Martin King before Martin went out on the balcony. Ralph went to put some aftershave lotion or cologne on his face and therefore did not go out on the balcony with Martin. So Martin was out there standing alone. Billy Kyles had knocked on the door of their room at 10 minutes to 6, and because Dr. King was going to have dinner, his whole group was having dinner at barbecue at Kyles' home that evening. So Kyles knocked on the door at 10 to 6. The door opened and then closed after a short time, and Kyles then walked down the balcony. For all of his professional career, Kyles tried to maintain he was in the room with Martin King for the last half hour of his life. Well, that was a lie. That's a fabrication, because not only when I confronted Ralph with this did he say, no, Billy Kyles is a liar, he was not in the room, but then I got the police surveillance report and the notes that Willie B. Richmond, the surveillance officer, took, showed exactly what I just said, that he knocked on the door at about 10 to 6, and then when it was closed, he walked down the balcony. And I had Willie B. Richmond, the police officer, testify at the 1999 trial that this was the case. So Kyles built up this false reputation and built a effectively built an image of himself over many years.
Yes,
but
he did.
Kyles was clearly a part of the operation to get Martin out around 6 o'clock, and that's what he was supposed to do.
William, we're going to take a break right now, and I'm going to come back. I want you to think about how you're going to answer this. To me, this was by far the most shocking thing that I had ever heard, and I thought, my God, what a movie ending this would make if they ever did the real story of the killing of Martin Luther King, is that he may not have died as a result of the gunshot wound, a single shot to the face, that in fact he may have died or been murdered in the hospital. We're going to be right back with Joe Satilli, who's going to join us.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Hi, this is John Barber of John Barber's World, every other Monday at 5 p.m. Pacific right here on BBS Radio. I'm telling you about a terrific show, The New Criminal Minds, with outstanding actor Gary Sinise, called Criminal Minds Beyond Borders, a tough drama about a special unit of the FBI involved in protecting Americans who are beyond borders. It follows the regular Criminal Minds, airing every Wednesday at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 Central. Don't miss it. Gary Sinise is outstanding.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Thank you for that smile upon your face, oh sunny.
Hi, this is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show. Or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me, with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber. He put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific, and I'd say historic, film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knack, Coast to Coast AM.
Thank you. Welcome back. And I'd like to thank George Knack for that wonderful unsolicited review for The Last Word on the Assassination, which you can get up there on Amazon, and the funds go to part two, which we're working on now. We're about halfway through the script, and helping us enormously in the script is Joe Satilli, who's my regular here, who's also joining me now to talk to William Pepper. William Pepper has just written this phenomenal book out by Skyhorse Publishing called The Plot to Kill the King. Dr. Pepper is the lawyer for the King family, who won a successful civil case against Lloyd Jowers and others that went totally unreported in the United States. Anyway, welcome back, Joe. Glad you're here. Hang on a second and join in. But first, William, the part of the book that rattled me, I literally had to stop reading and reread it two or three times. So I'm just going to I wrote down the name of the woman who told you the story. It was a gunshot to the jaw. Describe the gunshot. Would it have been fatal? And what happened when they got the body to the hospital?
Well, the gunshot entered the side of the face and went on a downward path, and exited, then re-entered again, and went into Dr. King's back and did nick the spine. Didn't sever it, but nicked the spine. So it was a very serious wound. Whether would he have survived that gunshot? It's doubtful. Because he was very seriously wounded. He was taken to St. Joseph's Hospital, and he was worked on in the emergency room of St. Joseph's Hospital, and he was still alive. He was breathing. They put a catheter in, and they were giving him the best emergency treatment that was available. They didn't take him up to a neurological operating room, but they kept him in the emergency room and were working on him there. The chief of surgery of the hospital was a fellow called Breen Bland, B-R-E-E-N-B-L-A-N-D, Dr. Breen Bland. He was also the family doctor of the Dixie Mafia family, the Russell Adkins family.
Oh.
And he, at one point, had a meeting with Russ Adkins, and our witness, the son of Russell Adkins, was present at that meeting as a boy, and as a teenage boy. And he often sat in on these meetings. His father started to involve him in the activities of the family from an early age. He remembered being taken to his first lynching when he was 6 years old.
Oh,
he was taken also by the father to the prison where the father delivered $25,000 to the warden in order to plan to organize the escape of James Earl Ray. They had profiled James as an ideal patsy, and they had to organize his escape so he could be then moved around and controlled until they needed him. Well, Ron Tyler Adkins went with his father. He was about 15 years old. Clyde Tolson brought this money in a brown paper bag, and they took it to the prison, gave it to the warden. So this was a young man who sat in on a lot of the activity and who knew much of the stuff that was going on at the family, and he sat in on the meeting, one meeting between his father and their family doctor, Dr. Bland. And they were discussing the assassination, and Bland said to him, to the father, "Just you've got to make sure whatever happens, if he isn't immediately killed by the bullet, then you've got to get him to my hospital, and I'll make sure that he doesn't leave alive."
Oh my!
So Martin King was not killed by the shot. He was gravely, seriously wounded. But he was alive, and he was taken, and he was in the emergency room.
Well, in the book, yeah. you mentioned first a woman who tells you this astonishing story.
This comes on.
Okay, The next thing is, how did she know there were military intelligence people in the hospital?
Well, first of all, she's not the only one. Everyone who was there at the hospital at that time saw people in uniform. There were military people all over the hospital. They were there, like it or not. They were all over the place. But what happened was she was a surgical nurse, and she was going in and out of the emergency room helping the doctors. And Dr. Bland came into the emergency room with two men in suits. Didn't know that they were military intelligence or who they were, but they were two men in suits. And they came in, and Bland said to the staff in the emergency room, "Stop working on that nigger and let him die. And now, all of you, get out of here." And he threw them all out of the emergency room. And as she was going out of the emergency room, she heard them gathering spit in their saliva in their mouth. And that caught her, that noise caught her attention, and she turned to look over her shoulder, and she saw the three of them spit on Dr. King's body, on the emergency room table, spit on his body. The catheter had already been pulled out from his throat, and she saw Dr. Bland take a pillow and put the pillow over his face and head and suffocate him to death. So she was kept in the hospital with the other staff overnight. They stayed there. They were only allowed to go the next morning. She went home. I never spoke to her. She died. But she called her family together the next morning, and her first words, she was very distraught and very depressed. And her first words, according to her son, whom we did depose under oath and film, she said, I don't know why they had to kill him. Why did they have to kill him, she said. She was beside herself that. And this boy, Jonathan Shelby, her son, kept that with him all his life. He's today a diabetes victim. He's blind. And he came forward and he offered to tell this story. Now he tells the story. And once again, I'm having to say these are allegations that a witness is making, and we take them as best we can. And I can only say I have no reason to believe that he has any reason to lie about any of this. It was shocking and distressing for him to go through this, to carry it all these years, and for his mother to have suffered this. And
it didn't,
to me,
Ralph,
this is...
Didn't Ralph Abernathy go around saying that he was there until the final end?
Abernathy made many statements that he was there. Mm-hmm. Abernathy was moved out of the room. Abernathy and I think Young were moved out of the room, and they were kept outside. They were not in there during this critical time. But, you know, I don't want to get into Ralph, because Ralph, there are too many questions I have about Ralph, but not really powerful evidence. But Ralph...
How about Andrew Young?
I have no doubt that Andrew Young had nothing to do with the assassination at all.
In fact,
Andy Young was a target. The military sharpshooters, the special ops guys, had two targets. They were given at Camp Shelby, and their briefing at 4:30 in the morning of the assassination, they were shown two photographs. One was Andy Young, and one was Martin King. So Andy himself was a target. But Ralph himself, I have a lot of questions about Ralph. He was not truthful in terms of the room. They never stayed in that room. They never stayed overnight at the Lorraine. They did go there, and they met people there during the day, but they never stayed overnight. And I had a police detective tell me, a guy I came to trust over the years, he was standing behind the lockers when the King group was going single file past the dead body on the table, and they were led by Ralph. And when Ralph got to Martin's body up to his head, he patted him by the side of the head and said, "Goodbye, old friend." And the detective said he wished he had a camera, because there was this enormous grin on Ralph's face. I mean, I'm just telling you again what I was told by this detective. So I have a lot of questions about Ralph, but I'm not making any allegations of Ralph, and I don't want to get into that. What I believe is that he was in the hospital, but that he was not in the emergency room.
Okay, and, Joe, I want you to ask.
Yeah.
I had one quick question, and then I want you to ask William some questions. It would seem to me that if the military was there, they were there before the shots were fired in order to be there. Did the House Select Committee have this information that you have about what happened in the hospital?
I have no idea what they ultimately what their investigators found. And I never read anything or had any indication from their people that they knew anything untoward was happening in the hospital. They certainly didn't know, or they didn't reveal, the existence of the Alpha 184 team. That was a sniper team, a sniper unit that was there, but they came out of Camp Shelby, Mississippi. But in that unit, in my view, did not in any way contribute to the killing of Dr. King, but they were there as a backup. And I think if the civilian did not get King, they were going to go into action. Martin King was never going to be allowed to leave Memphis, that I believe.
Go ahead, Joe.
And to that point, what the she was a young nurse who said, why did they have to kill them, to her son, right? And, you know, there is an unconventional wisdom as to why Martin Luther King was murdered. It generally comes back to, among those of us who believe that there was something nefarious afoot there, that he started to speak out against the Vietnam War, and his poverty message was not targeted solely to blacks. It was beginning to be broadened to impoverished whites. And these are two of the general, that's the sensibility about what made him so dangerous or more dangerous than he had been. But the question I have for you is, to what extent do you believe that the assassination of Martin Luther King was in effect a coup d'etat against independent black leadership in America?
Well, I think you could say that that was the case, and you're right that one of the major reasons was his increasing opposition to the war in Vietnam. And that was, of course, how I came to know him. I only knew him the last year of his life and was only close to him that last year. And that was as a result of my Ramparts piece, which the publishers have put in full in the book. And when I got back from Vietnam as a journalist, he read that Ramparts piece, and that's what brought us together. And I think he was so upset about the war crimes that are being committed that he felt he had to speak out, and he did. And this was going to the bottom lines of American energy and military corporations. Right. And so that was a major reason. But the other reason is perhaps more profound, and you've begun to touch on it. And it has to do with the fact that he was going to bring this mass of Americans, poor whites as well as blacks, to Washington. And they weren't going to demonstrate. It wasn't a march for demonstration. They were going to camp there. And then we're going to go to their congressmen and their senators, and they're going to try to get budgetary allocations go back into social programs rather than the war. And the military, I think correctly, the military realized that was not going to happen. And the military was afraid that there would be increasing anger and that he would probably lose control over that group. And they could have a revolution on their hands. Mm. Somebody was going to bring over 500,000 people there. They couldn't put that down. Westmoreland wanted 200,000 troops more. Additionally, in Vietnam, they didn't have those. They didn't have the forces to put down those troops. They were afraid, like what was going on in Paris, would go on there. Like the 100 cities had burned the year previously, and they were afraid they would not be able to stop that revolution. So they were determined. He was not going to organize those poor whites as well as the blacks. And about a coup, you know, I've come to look at political assassinations now much differently than I did before I started this work. I've come to see them in a historical perspective. And when you go back in history and you begin to look at all of the critical people who were killed by political assassinations by ruling forces, it's staggering.
Yeah.
There's been more impact on human history by this kind of action. And so Martin King, yes, he was a critical leader. And just as Malcolm was in 65, they got rid of Malcolm in 65, King had to be taken out. If they could have intimidated him, if they could have gotten him on wrecking his reputation, as they tried to do at one point, doing whatever else, political assassination is the last resort. And they only use it when they have to.
Joe, William, we only have a minute and a half left. So the book is called The Plot to Kill the King. Mr. Pepper, what do you think? Would Oprah Winfrey give you an hour so you could talk about this?
I don't think she'd touch this. I don't think most mainstream media will touch this. And I don't think most progressive radio programs will touch this story, John. You and Joe have been around the block, I'm sure, many times. And the consolidated control over mainstream media, and indeed over most progressive media, is lamentable. But I think it's a reality, and it's a credit to you guys, you, John, you, Joe, that, you know, you're willing to consider these issues because they go right to the heart of democracy in this republic.
Dr. Pepper, very quickly, why is it that it's so much harder to get this information out than it is the information about John F. Kennedy's assassination, where over 70% of Americans believe that there was a conspiracy? Why is MLK's assassination a hotter to handle subject than JFK's assassination?
Great question.
I don't know. Of course, JFK was killed 5 years earlier. There has been a greater legion of people who have worked on that case. I regard myself as being someone very naive. I thought they had the right guy when they got Ray. Very few people have really just dug in. You know, Joe, I've been at this. I was at this case for 39 years.
Right.
And if I quit the way most book writers do after 3 or 4 years, and did, I would never have had the information that came forward as people were getting older and getting nearer to the grave and wanting to bear their souls. But I just don't think the MLK assassination has attracted that degree of interest or research on behalf of people. There have been some talented people.
Well,
like
William, I must tell you, this book certainly will do it, because I don't think there is any, even if it's not reviewed by anybody, word of mouth alone. And Joe, you were telling me about some black progressive lady that you wanted us to interview.
Michelle Alexander.
Send her the book, okay, and see what she does, because this
she's a very bright woman. And she's the new Jim Crow, isn't she? I mean, she's a very bright,
yes,
very bright woman, and she will not have the historical perspective, and she may not want to get involved in political assassinations, but she certainly has made a contribution in
terms
of...
Well, William, I should tell you right now, there are half a dozen people who have already notified me that the book is on the way, The Plot to Kill the King by William Pepper out of Skyhorse. I want to thank... Mike Kim, our producer, and Doug, our engineer, and Joe, you and I are going to do 1 hour all by ourselves very, very shortly, because you're a treasure.
And we'll probably be talking about Dr. Pepper's work the whole time.
Well, bless us if we do. It's just fabulous. And also, William, take your family to see The Free State of Jones. You will love that movie.
Yeah, I understand. I heard your blurb on it, and it does sound like a fascinating one. I had to move my first family to England. I raised them in England because of I couldn't stand my 4-year-old getting threatening phone calls against his father. And,
well,
I want to
thank you. So, I thank you, Joe. Thank the audience so much. And we'll be talking to you again in a couple of weeks. Good night. And as Ed Murray used to say, good luck.
Spark of nature's fire, you're my sweet complete desire, a sunny, 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 sunny.